Hello, it's just about 6 p.m. here at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And of course, you can always also stream us online at weft.org. That tune I just played was This I Dig of You. That was by the Jimmy Cobb Quartet. That was with Peter Bernstein on guitar, Harold Mubburn on piano, John Weber on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on the drums. In case if you're wondering, if this is Where Are We At, which is a public affairs kind of program, it's my third show. My name is Ben Theobald. I'm usually the host of this program here at WEFT. At this time, just a little bit after 6 p.m., if I can kind of give you a weather update, it's about 38 degrees, some humidity, about 86%, but it'll get down mostly just about low 30s tonight, and tomorrow morning it will get be just about the same, except there is a very high chance of rain tomorrow morning starting around 5 or 6 a.m. 30% up to, 55% chance of rain at around 6 a.m. And then I'm looking at the weather.com site and having a little trouble with the it'll possibly rain all the way up to 10 a.m. with showers, and then it'll get up back into the 40s to in the afternoon, and then stay that way, and then be kind of what it is now tomorrow night. So kind of expect kind of cold and wet, unfortunately, tomorrow. And let's see, I'm gonna play before I get to kind of what's going on with news nationally. Tomorrow, November 19th, marks the anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which was his 272 word speech that he gave during November 19th, 1863, on the battlefield near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Of course, this is the whole famous, his famous 470 years ago. So this is, and I believe this audio was, this speech was read by Jeff Daniels, the actor. So just, this is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
On this continent, a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here, dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
And oops, my levels. Still getting used to being back here at WEFT and learning how to speak into a microphone. Yes, and that was, again, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, thanks to C. Parsons, played by the YouTube on C. Parsons' 2005 channel. And, of course, the impeachment inquiry into the, that's still happening in Washington. This is an article I reading on the New York Times by Charlie Savage that was just published today. According, impeachment investigators are exploring whether President Trump lied in his written answers to Robert Mueller during the Russia investigation, according to a lawyer for the White House, for the House, sorry, the I take it this is for the House of Representatives, told a federal appeals court on Monday, raising the prospect of bringing an additional basis for a Senate trial whether to remove President Trump. The statement during a hearing in a case over the House's request for a secret grand jury evidence gathered by Robert Mueller came shortly after Mr. Trump said he may provide written answers about the Ukraine affair to impeachment investigators. Quote, and this is a quote, even though I did nothing wrong, this is a quote by Mr. Trump, by President Trump, they wrote on Twitter, even though I did nothing wrong, I don't like giving credibility to this no due process hoax. I like the idea and will, in order to get Congress focused again, strongly consider it. That was President Trump on Twitter, and this is the New York Times article continues. But the hearing heightened focus on House suspicions that Mr. Trump had lied to Mr. Mueller's investigators when he provided lawyerly written answers to some questions. Mr. Trump had refused to testify orally to the special counsel's office about what he knew and did during the 2016 campaign in relation to Russia's election interference operation or his latter efforts to impede the inquiry. And his responses, which were appended to the Mueller report, President Trump denied that he was aware of any communications between his campaign and WikiLeaks. House lawyers, this is the House of Representatives, the lawyers of the House had suggested in a September 30th filing that some of the materials they were seeking bore on whether Mr. Trump was honest about that. On Monday, Douglas Leder, who is the general counsel for the House, told a federal appeals court panel that impeachment investigators have an immense need to swiftly see the grand jury evidence, redacted portions of Mueller report, as well as the underlying testimony transcripts they came from. And this is another quote by Mr. Leder, the general counsel for the House of Representatives. Quote, was the president not truthful in his response to the Mueller investigation, Mr. Leder said, adding, I believe the special counsel said the president had been untruthful in some of his answers. He was referring to Mr. Mueller's, and the article continues that he was referring to Mr. Mueller's congressional testimony in July. Near the end of the hearing, a lawmaker brought up Mr. Trump's written response and asked whether his answers showed that he wasn't always being truthful. Rather than demurring, as he had to similar questions, Mr. Mueller instead appeared to confirm her assessment, responding. So, yeah, it's... I believe the impeachment inquiry is supposed to continue this week. Not sure those who are testifying. I do apologize. I was hopefully, but I'll get that information here as I play another kind of. This week in history that just give me one quick this week, I believe it was November 20th, President Obama gave the Presidential Medal of Freedom to civil rights activist Bayard Rustin. He was not very well known as, unfortunately, civil rights activist, and he, I believe, was honored. He was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama, I believe, in November 20th, 2013. So, and there, fortunately, aren't much full speeches, just kind of excerpts of Bayard Rustin. So, I'm just going to play some of audio of, unfortunately, these are just kind of excerpts, not full speeches. So, without further ado, this is just Bayard Rustin kind of some of the speeches and that he gave.
If you can't get a decent salary for men who are working in the name of God, how the hell are you going to get rid of poverty? All over the country, people are telling me, you can't depend on the unions. They're anti-Negro. They won't stand with you. Well, I think the record here shows that in Memphis, this fight is going to be won because the black people of this community and the trade unions stand together, man to man.
We call for a nonviolent uprising, with people sitting, standing, being arrested, white and black together. Our power is in our ability to make things unworkable. The only weapon we have is our bodies, and we need to tuck them in places so wheels don't turn.
Am I supposed to go back to Harlem and tell the people they have to wait until the Vietnam War is over before money can be got? No, I think we have to put up a political fight for it. I do not believe the war in Vietnam is more important than eradicating poverty, and I think history will reveal that.
What I want to know is, with what politician will you agree in November if they don't get off their fannies and do something?
And yeah, again, that was Bayard Rustin. Oops, sorry, not going to play any more of that. Unfortunately, yeah, not much audio there, but that was by Union Solidarity YouTube. Thank you for YouTube channel for having that audio, just kind of excerpts, and unfortunately not kind of full speeches, but But yeah, he was given the Presidential Medal of Honor Freedom by then President Obama, I think around 2013, November 20th. So I'm kind of constantly repeating myself. Let's get some announce or kind of some public service announcements. Unfortunately, can't see them from where I am. The Champaign Men's Emergency Winter Shelter is available now through April 15th of next year, April 15th, 2020, between the hours of 8 p.m. and 7 a.m. The shelter is located at 70 East Washington Street on Champaign, which is the former Times Center location. There are some snacks available, but no meals are served. Showers and laundry are not available. If you want, you can contact them at 217-819-5469. And after business hours, there's also a number for after business hours, kind of like a later time. Then that number is 217-888-0329. There's also the Champaign Women's Emergency Shelter, known as Austin's Place, which is available now through April 15th between the hours of 7:30 p.m. and 7 a.m. Screening for the shelter will occur at Courage Connection, 504 East Church Street, Champaign, from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. each evening. Transportation to the shelter at First United Methodist Church is provided by volunteers. Again, there are snacks available, but no meals are served. Showers and laundry are not available. Excuse me. Guests will be provided with bus tokens in the morning. For more information, you can contact Ruth Moore. The number is 217-356-9078. And there's also another number for after business hours, or kind of like a late time. And that number is 217-888-0329. So yeah, it's the same number as, or it's same number as the, I guess, St. Andrew's Church is located at 909 South Wright Street, and that's in Urbana. And at 5:45 p.m., community meals on Wednesday are served by fellowship, Bible study, and discussion. Now they have showers that are available for women on Tuesday and Friday, from 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. during Austin's Place operating session. And of course, there's also the Phoenix Center, which provides a year-round drop-in center and winter daytime warming site for those in our community that need a place to stay. Those hours of operation are Tuesday to Friday from noon to 5 p.m. Additional hours are to be added, ranging between 7:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. When daytime temperatures drops below 10 degrees and are based on volunteer availability. The Phoenix is located at 70 East Washington Street in Champaign. There are also other locations to stay warm, and those include buildings And these are during normal business hours. Some of those location or places are the Champaign Public Library, the Urbana Free Library, the Lincoln Square Mall, and Marketplace Mall. And I think that's in terms of any kind of public service announcements or any kind of, I think it's, I'll see if there's any more, but for considering that's kind of a seasonal, timely one, that's a really important one to know. Of course, the views and opinions expressed on air here on West, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. I have a so this kind of theme of today's show has been kind of what's been going on with the impeachment, and I'm just gonna kind of play kind of things that happened with past impeachments, mostly with President Nixon, and with his theme, what happened with that impeachment, kind of just in terms of what was going on, fits more properly with President Bill Clinton, with Bill Clinton's impeachment. It was more, that was more about lying for, well, what happened with, of course, with his affair and this. So, but this is about the, this is a speech I want, or not speech, well, it is a speech that Barbara Jordan, who was an American lawyer, educator, and politician, she was a leader of the, the civil rights movement. She was a Democratic politician. She was the first African American elected to the Texas Senate after Reconstruction, and the first Southern African American woman elected to the United States of House Representatives. This is a speech she gave during the impeachment of President Nixon in 1974. And yeah, I'm going to play that for you right now, hopefully, once I get it set up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chairman, I join my colleague, Mr. Rangel, in thanking you for giving the junior members of this committee the glorious opportunity of sharing the pain of this inquiry. Mr. Chairman, you are a strong man, and it has not been easy, but we have tried as best we can to give you as much assistance as possible. Earlier today, we heard the beginning of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We the people. It's a very eloquent beginning. But when that document was completed on the 17th of September in 1787, I was not included in that we the people. I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in we the people. Today, I am an inquisitor. And hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness that I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution. Who can so properly be the inquisitors for the nation as the representatives of the nation themselves? The subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men. And that's what we're talking about. In other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. It is wrong, I suggest, it is a misreading of the Constitution for any member here to assert that for a member to vote for an article of impeachment means that that member must be convinced that the president should be removed from office. The Constitution doesn't say that. The powers relating to impeachment are an essential check in the hands of the body, the legislature, against and upon the encroachments of the executive. The division between the two branches of the legislature, the House and the Senate, assigning to the one the right to accuse and to the other the right to judge. The framers of this Constitution were very astute. They did not make the accusers and the judges and the judges the same person. We know the nature of impeachment. We've been talking about it a while now. It is chiefly designed for the president and his high ministers to somehow be called into account. It is designed to bridle the executive if he engages in excesses. It is designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. The framers confided in the Congress the power, if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical and preservation of the independence of the executive. The nature of impeachment, a narrowly channeled exception to the separation of powers maxim. The Federal Convention of 1787 said that. It limited impeachment to high crimes and misdemeanors and discounted and opposed the term maladministration. It is to be used only for great misdemeanors, so it was said in the North Carolina Ratification Convention. And in the Virginia Ratification Convention, we do not trust our liberty to a particular branch. We need one branch to check the other. No one need be afraid. The North Carolina Ratification Convention, no one need be afraid that officers who commit oppression will pass with immunity. Prosecutions of impeachments will seldom fail to agitate the passions of the whole community, said Hamilton in the Federalist Papers number 65. We divide into parties, more or less friendly or inimical to the accused. I do not mean political parties in that sense. The drawing of political lines goes to the motivation behind impeachment, but impeachment must proceed within the confines of the constitutional term, high crime and misdemeanors. Of the impeachment process, it was Woodrow Wilson who said that nothing short of the grossest offenses against the plain law of the land will suffice to give them speed and effectiveness. Indignation so great as to overgrow party interest may secure a conviction, but nothing else can. Common sense would be revolted if we engaged upon this process for petty reasons. Congress has a lot to do. Appropriations, tax reform, health insurance, campaign finance reform, housing, environmental protection, energy sufficiency, mass transportation. Pettiness cannot be allowed to stand in the face of such overwhelming problems. So today we're not being petty. We're trying to be big because the task we have before us is a big one. This morning, in a discussion of the evidence, we are told that the evidence which purports to support the allegations of misuse of the CIA by the president is thin. We're told that that evidence is insufficient. What that recital of the evidence this morning did not include is what the president did know on June the 23rd, 1972. The president did know that it was Republican money, that it was money from the Committee for the Re-election of the President, which was found in the possession of one of the burglars arrested on June the 17th. What the president did know on the 23rd of June was the prior activities of E. Howard Hunt, which included his participation in the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, which included Howard Hunt's participation in the Dieter Beard ITT affair, which included Howard Hunt's fabrication of cables designed to discredit the Kennedy administration. We were further cautioned today that perhaps these proceedings ought to be delayed because certainly there would be new evidence forthcoming from the President of the United States. There has not even been an obfuscated indication that this committee would receive any additional materials from the President. The committee subpoena is outstanding, and if the President wants to supply that material, the committee sits here. The fact is that on yesterday, the American people waited with great anxiety for 8 hours, not knowing whether their president would obey an order of the Supreme Court of the United States. At this point, I would like to juxtapose a few of the impeachment criteria with some of the actions the president has engaged in. Impeachment criteria. James Madison, from the Virginia Ratification Convention. If the president be connected in any suspicious manner with any person and there be grounds to believe that he will shelter him, he may be impeached. We have heard time and time again that the evidence reflects the payment to defendants, money. The president had knowledge that these funds were being paid, and these were funds collected for the 1972 presidential campaign. We know that the president met with Mr. Henry Peterson 27 times to discuss matters related to Watergate, and immediately thereafter met with the very persons who were implicated in the information Mr. Peterson was receiving. The words are, if the president is connected in any suspicious manner with any person, and there be grounds to believe that he will shelter that person, he may be impeached. Just a story. Impeachment is intended for occasional and extraordinary cases where a superior power acting for the whole people is put into operation to protect their rights and rescue their liberties from violations. We know about the Houston plan. We know about the break-in of the psychiatrist's office. We know that there was absolute, complete direction on September 3rd when the president indicated that a surreptitious entry had been made in Dr. Fielding's office after having met with Mr. Ehrlichman and Mr. Young. Protect their rights, rescue their liberties from violation. The Carolina Ratification Convention impeachment criteria. Those are impeachable who behave amiss or betray their public trust. Beginning shortly after the Watergate break-in and continuing to the present time, the president has engaged in a series of public statements and actions designed to thwart the lawful investigation by government prosecutors. Moreover, the president has made public announcements and assertions bearing on the Watergate case, which the evidence will show he knew to be false. These assertions, false assertions, impeachable, those who misbehave, those who behave amiss or betray the public trust. James Madison again at the Constitutional Convention. A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. The Constitution charges the president with the task of taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. And yet, the president has counseled his aides to commit perjury, willfully disregard the secrecy of grand jury proceedings, conceal surreptitious entry, attempt to compromise a federal judge, while publicly displaying his cooperation with the processes of criminal justice. A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. If the impeachment provision in the Constitution of the United States will not reach the offenses charged here, then perhaps that 18th century Constitution should be abandoned to a 20th century paper shredder. Has the president committed offenses and planned and directed and acquiesced in a course of conduct which the Constitution will not tolerate? That's the question. We know that. We know the question. We should now forthwith proceed to answer the question. It is reason and not passion which must guide our deliberations, guide our debate, and guide our decision.
And thank you to YouTube channel People Planet Peace Over Profit for having that speech by Barbara C. Jordan. Just another announcement or reading, law reading, as we call it here at WEFT. WEFT programming is made possible by Cranet Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Nutcracker on December 5th, 6th, 7th, and the 8th, Champaign Urbana Ballet and Champaign Urbana Symphony Orchestra will return for 6 performances of this magical, family-friendly holiday classic set to Tchaikovsky's beloved score. And of course, for more information, feel free to go to Cranert Center. That's all one word. Well, for CranertCenter.com. And I'm going to kind of play. Yes, November 17th marks the anniversary of, believe it or not, Richard Nixon's a press conference that President Richard Nixon gave in 1973. Where he famously said, "I am not a crook," and I'm going to play quite a bit of that. Not all of it, but hopefully, this is that press conference.
2 years as a congressman, 2 years as a senator, and 8 years at $45,000 a year as vice president, and after stories have been written, particularly in the Washington Post, to the effect that the president had purchased a mansion in Wesley Heights and people wondered where the money came. You know what my net worth was? $47,000 total after 14 years of government service and a 1958 Oldsmobile that needed an overhaul. Now, I have no complaints. In the next 8 years, I made a lot of money. I made $250,000 from a book and the serial rights, which many of you were good enough to purchase also. In the practice of law, and I'm not claiming I was worth it, but apparently former vice presidents or presidents are worth a great deal to law firms, and I did work pretty hard. But also in that period, I earned between $100,000 and $250,000 every year. So that when I, in 1968, decided to become a candidate for president, I decided to clean the decks and to put everything in real estate. I sold all my stock for $300,000. That's all I own. I sold my apartment in New York for $300,000. I'm using rough figures here. And I had $100,000 coming to me from the law firm. And so that's where the money came from. Let me just say this. And I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes. But in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
President, Harry Rosenfeld of the Washington Post. Sir, there have been reports that the Secret Service was asked at your direction or authorization to tap the telephone of your brother, Donald Nixon. Is this true, sir? And if so, why?
That, of course, is a question that has been commented upon before. It will not take long to respond to it. The Secret Service did maintain a surveillance. They did so for security reasons, and I will not go beyond that. They were very good reasons, and my brother was aware of it. And may I say, too, to my friend from the Washington Post, I like your sport page. And also, be sure Povich isn't paid too much for that I just said. Go ahead.
Sir, Edward Miller, Allentown, Pennsylvania. Was your brother aware before or after the fact of the surveillance?
Before or after the fact?
Yes.
He was aware during the fact because he asked about it and he was told about it and he approved of it. He knew why it was done.
Sir, excuse me, does it make any sense to conduct surveillance when somebody knows about it?
Does it make any sense? Certainly. The surveillance involved not what he was doing. The surveillance involved what others who were trying to get him, perhaps to use improper influence and so forth, might be doing, and particularly anybody who might be in a foreign country.
Is some of this full story that you say you can't say now because of national security? Well, have you told that to congressmen or anyone else? Will this story come out in the next few weeks as you present more of the facts?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I should tell all of the editors that, and I don't want to leave any implication that you have not tried to publish as much as you could. You've just got so much room in your newspapers. But I do want you to know that, well, since you haven't raised some of these subjects, I'll raise them myself. ITT, how do we raise the price of milk? I wish somebody had asked me that one. And who else wanted it raised? What about the situation with regard to the $1 million secret stock portfolio that you have, a few of those things? I think all of those things need to be answered and answered effectively. And I think the best way to answer them, twofold. One, obviously through the medium of a televised conference like this, but two, through sending to the editors of the nation's newspapers, all 10,000 of them, the facts. And I trust that you will use them. And if you don't believe them, I don't mean what I mean. I'm not suggesting that you wouldn't believe them. But if you feel you need more information, write to me, and I'll give it to you. I want the facts out, because the facts will prove that the president is telling the truth. Now we go to the, I think we go to the back this time.
And Mr. President, John Finnegan, St. Paul Dispatch, Pioneer Press. I know the Watergate situation has raised questions of executive privilege, and a recent Gallup poll indicated that 62% of the American people will favor a confidential news source law if adopted by Congress. There is a two-tiered law now before the Judiciary Committee, which would provide an absolute privilege in case of investigative or grand jury hearings, and a qualified shield in case of a civil or criminal case. If such a law were passed, would you sign it or veto it?
You're talking about Shield laws in generally, are you not?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, my attitude toward the Shield laws, briefly, is this. First, I share the objective. I believe that reporters, if you're going to have a free press, ought to have some kind of a shield. Second, except, of course, if they're involved in criminal activities, and then I don't think the Shield law that any of suggested would cover those. As I understand, if there are criminal activities involved in by a reporter, obviously, a Shield law can't protect it. The second point, however, has to do with the particular legislation and how it reaches my desk, and I'll have to take a look at it when it gets there to see if it's proper. If it's proper, I'll sign it. But I think that a Shield law, which would have the effect of providing to reporters what the general public felt after they had a chance to consider it all, provide for them privileges that went beyond what the general public thought was in the national interest, then I would have to take a second look. Now, incidentally, I should point out, too, that I followed your editorials, not yours and just the St. Paul paper, but others around the country, and the newspapers in this country are not united on this. So on the Shield law, I'm not trying to duck the question. It's an open question. But I will answer one thing I think is important. The new Attorney General, Mr. Saxby, under my directions, will follow this practice. any federal case involving a reporter will not be brought unless it is, comes expressly to the Attorney General and he approves it. Because that way, that's a pretty good shield, I think.
May I ask one other question, sir?
Sure.
Do you feel that the executive privilege is absolute?
I, of course, don't. I have waived executive privilege with regard to all of the members of my staff who have any knowledge of or who have had any charges against, have been made against in the Watergate matter. I have, of course, voluntarily waived privilege with regard to turning over the tapes and so forth. Let me point out, it was voluntary on my part, and deliberately so, to avoid a precedent that might destroy the principle of confidentiality for future presidents, which is terribly important. If it had gone to the Supreme Court, and I know many of my friends argued, why not carry it to the Supreme Court and let them decide it? That would first have had a confrontation with the Supreme Court between the Supreme Court and the president, and second, it would have established very possibly a precedent breaking down constitutionality that would plague future presidencies, not just presidents. I could just say in that respect, too, that I referred to what I call the Jefferson Rule. And it's the rule I think that we should generally follow. A president should follow with the courts when they want information, and a president should also follow with committees of Congress when they want information from his personal files. Jefferson, as you know, in that very, very famous case, had correspondence which it was felt might bear upon the guilt or innocence of Aaron Burr. Chief Justice Marshall, sitting as a trial judge, said that held that Jefferson, as president, had to turn over the correspondence. Jefferson refused. What he did was to turn over a summary of the correspondence, all that he considered was proper to be turned over for the purposes of the trial. And then Marshall, as sitting as Chief Justice, ruled for the president. Now, why did Jefferson do that? Jefferson didn't do that to protect Jefferson. He did that to protect the presidency. And that's exactly what I will do in these cases. It isn't for the purpose of protecting the president. It is for the purpose of seeing that the presidency, where great decisions have to be made, and great decisions can't be made unless there is very free flow of conversation, and that means confidentiality, I have a responsibility to protect that presidency. At the same time, I will do everything I can to cooperate where there is a need for presidential participation. I'll come to you next, sorry.
Mr. President, Murray Light, Buffalo Union News. The American people, sir, are very interested in one subject other than Watergate. Is gas rationing imminent?
Well, I didn't hear the last, I'm sorry.
Is gas rationing imminent?
I'll tell you a little about my career that I didn't put in my campaign folders when I ran for Congress in 1946. I was once in OPA, and I was in tire rationing. I suppose they put me in tire rationing. This is just before I went into the service. I was waiting for my service call because I had worked in a service station. But I didn't know anything about tire rationing. And neither did the man above me, who I don't think had ever been in a service station. But we put out the rationing regulations on tires, and we were as fair as we could be. But also, I found that if you get a bunch of government bureaucrats, and in order to have rationing, you'd have to have thousands of them making decisions with regard to who's going to get this much in rationing. If you're going to try to do that in peacetime, when you do not have what we had in wartime, you know, support for, you know, don't use a C ration card when you're only entitled to an A. Then you're sort of disloyal or something, or unpatriotic. If you do not have that behind it, I can assure you that a rationing system in peacetime, run by a group of well-intentioned, but being bureaucrats that they are, gaining and feeling their power, would be something that the American people would resent very, very much. Now, what we have asked the Congress for is for a contingency plan in the event that rationing becomes necessary. But in the meantime, let me tell you, our goal is to make it not necessary. I'm not going to pledge to this audience, and I'm not going to pledge to the television audience, that rationing may never come. if you have another war in the Mideast, if you have a complete cutoff and not a resumption of the flow of oil from the Mideast, or some other disaster occurs, rationing may come. But if, on the other hand, the things that I recommended in my message of a week ago for immediate action, if the voluntary cooperation of keeping the speed down to 50 miles an hour, and I'm going to talk to the governors about that on Tuesday in Memphis, urging that every state do exactly the same thing, if we cut back on the aircraft flights, and we've done that, and for example, I came down here in a plane here today, Air Force One, I asked them if I couldn't take the Jetstar. They said, no, it doesn't have communications. So I had to take the big plane. But we did one thing that saved half the cost. We didn't have the backup plane. Secret Service didn't like it. Communications didn't like it. But I don't need a backup plane. This one goes down, it goes down. And then they don't have to impeach. So.
Mr. President.
Mr. President, Larry Allison from the Long Beach, California, Independent Press Telegram. Back to Watergate. Former Attorney General John Mitchell has testified that the reason he did not give you details on the Watergate problems was that you did not ask him. Now, I realize that you were very busy at that time, as you said, but there were reports in newspapers that linked people very high on your staff with the Watergate problems. Could you tell us, sir, why you did not ask Mr. Mitchell what he knew?
For the very simple reason that when I talked to Mr. Mitchell, and I saw him often in that period, that I had every reason to believe that if he were involved, if he had any information to convey, he would tell me. I thought that he would. As a matter of fact, when I called him on the telephone, what did he say? He expressed chagrin that anything like that could have happened in his organization. Looking back, maybe I should have cross-examined and say, John, did you do it? I probably should have asked him, but the reason I didn't is that I expected him to tell me. And he had every opportunity to, and decided that he wouldn't, apparently. At least, now that doesn't mean to tell me that he was involved, because you understand that's still a matter that's open. The question is whether he could have told me about other people that might be involved, or he had information where members of my staff did not have information. Yes, sir.
I'm Joe Schoquist, Milwaukee Journal. Why didn't the administration anticipate the energy crisis several years ago, formulate a positive action plan to do something about it?
You walked into one there. And that's a great paper, incidentally, as is the Milwaukee Sentinel. But anyway, seriously, you see, what happened was that I sent the first energy message ever sent to the Congress. I sent it to the Congress over 2 years ago. I saw this thing coming. And you know why I saw it coming? Not because of the Mideast or the Alaska pipeline and the rest, but because this world, with all of its problems, is getting richer. Oh, I don't mean there aren't a lot of hungry people, in not only in America, too many here, but if you want to see hungry people, go to India or go to some of the countries in Latin America or Upper Brazil, et cetera, et cetera. But generally, as the world gets richer, there's more air conditioning, there's more need for power, and there's more need for energy. And that's why I sent the message 2 years ago and asked at that time that the Congress consider a program so that the United States should become self-sufficient in energy. All right. I followed that up this year in April, before we even knew there might be or had any idea of the Mideast crisis, which made a serious problem a serious crisis. I asked them for 7 pieces of legislation to deal with energy. 1 has reached my desk, the Alaska pipeline. I signed it. The other 6, I hope they act before they go home for Christmas. Now, I'm not saying here the Congress is to blame. The president should have done something. What I do say is that the president warned about it and the Congress did not act, even though he warned 2 years ago. The president warned April, the Congress did not act. And now it's time for the Congress to get away from some of these other diversions, if they have time, and get on to this energy crisis. Let me just, since that question has come up, I would like to point out, though, how we should react, because the question about rationing is one that the...
And again, that was, of course, that was then President Richard Nixon with his press conference that he gave where he said, I'm not a crook. And thanks to Buyout Footage Historic Film Archive and that YouTube channel. House impeachment inquiry will begin its second week of public hearings with the Intelligence Committee reading a piece on NPR written by Darity Walsh. As I finish up this hour, of course, last week the Democrats launched the public phase of the inquiry with testimony from three public servants, William Taylor, the acting U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of European Affairs, and Marine Yanovich for the former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine. And, I believe the impeachment tomorrow, they will start tomorrow, which is Tuesday. The first panel will start at 9 a.m. Eastern, and the second panel will start at 2:30 p.m. Eastern. And that'll be it for my show here on where we are at. I'll be here next week, same time, 6 p.m. Monday. And this is Matt Guitar Murphy, his album, I believe it's Way Down South. And I believe this is Big City Takedown. So without further ado, stay tuned for more programming here at WEFT. Thank you.